ISIS. This doesn't work, yet it's costing us half of our discretionary budget and almost half of your income taxes. So it's very important that we have a new offensive in the Middle East. We call it a peace offensive, and it begins with a weapons embargo and with a freeze on the bank accounts of our allies, like Saudi Arabia, if they continue to insist on funding terrorist enterprises around the world.
Green
that
Party,
is the way forward.
Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein, as part of our Expanding the Debate two-hour special. We will do another hour of this debate. You can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadur, and Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org to see our 3.5-hour presidential debate special and our 2-hour special today. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO, Portland. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. Coming right up, Joanne Hardesty interviews Brian Shiko, co-author of The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. Your investment in community radio can go with a planned gift to KBOO. You can add KBOO as a designated beneficiary to your IRA, life insurance policy, retirement benefits, bank accounts and CDs, insurance, annuities, and more. Planned gifts can be made with cash, but many planned gifts are made by donating assets such as stocks, real estate, art pieces, and more. Contact Becky Myers at 503-231-8032, 503-231-8032, or email development at kboo.org to notify us of your plans. This is KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Friends of Noise Benefits Show on Sunday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Friends of Noise formed to create more opportunities for youth to produce, perform, and gather at all-ages music shows and raise awareness for the need of an all-ages venue. Performing at this benefit will be Explode Into Colors, Wampire, and Hugo Berlin. Again, that's Friends of Noise Benefit Show, Sunday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Progressive Spirit. I welcome Becky Garrison back to the show. She's going to talk about alternative spiritual communities, secular church, but it's not church. It's different.
No, if you build a better church, they're not going to come. But if you give experience where people can connect to themselves at their authentic core and be who they want to be, that seems to be where the Spirit is moving.
Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the film screening Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, on Friday, October 21 at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Since then, he has not stopped calling attention to the endless illegal wars being waged by the United States. Again, that's Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, on Friday, October 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to the program this morning. You might be surprised to hear my voice on a Monday, as am I, because Thursday is my normal day. But I am thrilled to have in the studio with me this morning Brian Sheehan. He is the author, the co-author of a new book, The Black Panthers, and is in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. It is so wonderful to have you here this morning. And as we were just saying briefly, I love this book because it talks about regular people, right? It doesn't talk about the superstars of the Black Panther movement. It talks about how regular people got engaged with the Black Panther Party and the work that they did on the ground to really make a difference in their local communities. And so why did you decide that this was the right story to tell?
Yeah, that's right. And what we're really talking about and how these Panthers refer to themselves as the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, one of the constant refrains that we heard as we went through this project and as we held the photo shoots and traveled around to about 10 different locations was that the story of the rank and file had never really been told.
Right.
The story of the Black Panthers is almost always told from the top down, from the actions of the founders, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale.
Right.
Of course, Eldridge Cleaver, Emory Douglas. And we felt like that history has been really pretty well covered. I mean, the Panthers are an amazingly dynamic and complex and even controversial organization. But almost every book, every film that comes out has been told from that sort of leadership perspective.
Right.
And of course that's valuable. Of course everyone has to know what was happening at that level, how decisions were made, because those filtered out through the rank and file and they were the ones that carried out those orders, for lack of a better word. But as I said, the more photographs that we captured and the more people that we talked to, it was always a desire to have their story told, and mm-hmm. we found the same value. We found the same value in that, and we also thought it was a unique way to approach the party that could really add something to the literature that was already in existence.
Well, I certainly know. Last year, the Black Panther movie came out, right? A new version,
right? Stanley Nelson.
Yes, by Stanley Nelson, and I found the film wonderful, but I also know that there was a lot of pushback, right? Because people were concerned that women weren't shown in the light that they should have been shown in. There's also that misnomer about the Black Panther Party being just black, right? Which was just black and male, right?
Right.
Which is certainly not what the Black Panther Party was. All around the country. And what I noticed about your book is how unique the individual chapters were, because there's a woman from Winston-Salem that talked about the work that they did on the ground in Winston-Salem, which looked a lot different than the work that, say, Oakland did on the ground.
Right.
And the people who were involved. And so you had the privilege of actually speaking to some of these people who today are professors and lawyers and artists, and they have a whole host of careers. And what were you most struck by in these conversations?
Oh, so much. So I was on my way over to the interview thinking about all of the different things that I was struck by. And what I tell, I don't really have a way to express how grateful I am for the kind of trust that I was given to do this project, which took over 5 years. Mm. And it was really what you're looking at, this book in front of you, represents in 5 years of building trust and building relationships.
Mm.
And to be able to get the really kind of personal, detailed stories that we were able to get represents something. I'm very proud of that, actually. Mm-hmm. And the person that you're referring to, I believe, is Hazel Mack.
Yes, yes.
From the Winston-Salem chapter.
Yes.
And she is now a lawyer, and also co-founded a very successful charter school, mm-hmm. actually, in Winston-Salem. And one of the things, just to answer your question, mm-hmm. one of the things that I was deeply, deeply struck by was how committed these Panthers and former Panthers, depending on who you talk to, that's right. how they refer to themselves,
right.
is how committed they still have been.
Yes.
And 50 years later, they are lawyers, professors, community activists, mm-hmm. artists, almost to the person, almost to the person. They're still deeply, deeply involved in social justice, mm-hmm. Community development. Mm-hmm. It was very, very inspiring.
And when they joined the Black Panther Party, most were teenagers.
They were kids. They were
absolutely
babies.
Yes.
Babies. Just to give you one idea, one woman that I spoke with, Thelma Laguerre, she is from Corona, Queens in New York. She was 14 years old when she joined the party. Mm. And I think when I was 14, I was worried about whether I was going to make the baseball team.
That was
the extent. Or could I get this new video game? Is that going to be it?
Exactly.
And these people were out literally in the streets. They were selling the Black Panther newspaper. They were confronting the authorities right and left at all levels of society.
Right.
She had told me that even though she was essentially a child, she had been arrested and placed in jail for a week, no access to attorneys, nothing like that, in a women's prison. And this was for adults, and she was 15 years old. And it's actually because they were so young that we have the chance now, actually, to speak with them and to hear their stories and to learn about the Panthers from their perspective.
Right. Not to mention that having living legends in our midst, right? People who did extraordinary things as children, right? It's just pretty phenomenal. And so when I talk to young people, when I go to colleges and high schools, I'm always reminding them that, you know, the Panthers were their age, right?
Right.
And they decided that the adults were moving way too slow. And so they had to take action. I find that pretty phenomenal. If you're just joining the call, I'm talking to Brian Shee. He's the co-author of The Black Panthers, a new book on the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. It's Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. I love the title because almost to a person, people talk about that the Panthers wasn't all good and it wasn't all bad. And there were influences that actually prevented the Black Panthers Party from really realizing their dream. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, I think the title, we love the title too. It was when we heard it, we had gone back and forth with a couple of titles and we were getting locked in. And then actually it was an editor at our publisher who came up with this beautiful, poetic and powerful title.
Yes.
That contains so much information about the party. I think obviously the two most important words are unfinished and revolution.
Right. Yes, yes.
And I think that's the attitude that almost everybody that I spoke to had about their efforts and about their activities was that this was something that they never got to finish. Mm. And that was a result of bigger political factors that were happening in
the
world.
Whether it was COINTELPRO.
But definitely more closer to home is COINTELPRO, which was a counterintelligence program launched. I think it was launched before J. Edgar Hoover took office, but he is the one that really used it as a hammer to target specifically all kinds of revolutionary groups, but most heavily the hammer came down on the Black Panthers. And that came down in the form of infiltrations, permission for local authorities to infiltrate the party, there's some stories in the book about how agent provocateurs would be used, excuse me, to actually disrupt the party, to set them up.
Yes.
There's a really illuminating story by a gentleman named Melvin Dixon, who was, I believe, from the Seattle chapter. He's currently in the San Francisco Bay Area. Mm-hmm. But they were driving back from Washington, D.C., from a rally. And he said the whole way there was a couple of guys that had joined from Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
at the last minute and had joined the caravan. And they had stolen some typewriters along the way when they'd stopped off. Actually, it was here in Oregon. They had stolen some bullets from a gas station and some snow chains. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised that they sold bullets at gas stations back then. But,
right.
The gas station attendant saw this. They saw him pick up the phone. They pulled over, ditched all the contraband, basically all the hot items. But as they continued on the road, they were still busted, basically by a huge phalanx of local police. And they had a lawyer that came down from Seattle that was able to get them released. But the two guys that they had picked up from Tacoma were immediately separated from them by the authorities. They were never charged, and they knew that these guys had set them up because they were doing some kind of nefarious things along the whole journey.
Right.
And according to Melvin, it was just very common practice for the police to take somebody, arrest them for something, whether justified or unjustified, and basically promise them some kind of leniency if they would act and if they would basically be spies.
Wow.
And agent provocateurs. And I think it was really important to include those stories. We call them, there's two of them in the book, and they're called Anatomy of a Setup 1 and 2. Mm. Because it's a constant refrain that you hear from the pants. We were set up. And if you don't know the details, it sounds like an excuse.
That's right. Absolutely true. And not so different than today. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Let me tell you a little about Brian Shih. He is a photojournalist and former contributor to the Financial Times and National Public Radio in Japan. His work on the Black Panthers led to his selection for the New York Times inaugural portfolio review in 2013 and garnered him one of the highest rankings among entries in the Lens Culture 2015 Portrait Awards competition. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So want to make sure people know who I'm talking to. What's interesting about what you've just said is how similar that is to what's happening with Black Lives Matters now, as well as what's happening with Native Americans for the Dakota Pipeline, right? What the public gets from the normal media is a totally different story than what the reality is on the ground. And so it's interesting that some of the same tactics are still being used, right? Infiltrating racial justice groups, sending out misinformation. And so I'm very glad that that was included, because as the president of the NAACP, I expect that every day, because that is also the history of the NAACP. We've always had agent provocateurs and always spies that are there to try to either create conflict or to report back to the powers that be.
Right.
So some things just haven't changed in 50 years.
Yeah, I have a panel discussion in Los Angeles later this week, and there will be three of the Panthers from the book in there, as well as the local
Black Lives Matter. Nice.
I guess chapter head.
Right.
And so that's definitely something that we want to talk about, is how, because COINTELPRO did not go away.
No.
They might have changed the name.
Yes.
Maybe now there's such a heavy focus on electronic surveillance. But we know these things are happening. We know it happened in the Occupy.
That's right.
Occupy movement in New York and through all of those actions that took place all over the world.
Absolutely.
It just seems to be the standard response of the government and power structure.
Absolutely, because over the last couple of weeks, I've been putting a lot of pressure on our local mayor, and all of a sudden, it takes my emails a week to get to their destination. Some email addresses, I can't even send people stuff to. You send it, and it just disappears. I was trying to respond to an email the other day, and it disappeared while I was reading it. I mean, really weird things.
You're watching this, you're typing it, and you're just watching it vanish in front of you?
Well, somebody sent it to me, and I started to read it. And as I started to read it, it just disappeared.
Oh, jeez.
And I went back to my inbox. It wasn't there, right? And so, and because I know the local police, they brought Homeland Security to keep the public out of our city hall last week. They had TriMet Police, they had Gresham Police. And so the fact that these policing systems have been improved since the Black Panther days, and now you're absolutely, I believe that anytime you are trying to change a power structure in our government, you know that you're under surveillance. And it's much more severe than the Black Panthers could have ever imagined it to be.
Right.
So we have a caller on the line. Good morning, LJ. Welcome to KBOO. Haven't heard from you in a long time. How are you?
Oh, not too bad for an old man.
It sure beats the alternative, doesn't it?
Yeah, really. I just want to quickly go over a couple of things. I want to the October 10th issue of the Guardian of the Nation magazine has Sisters of the Revolution, four women who helped build the Black Panther Party, and it's a really nice, simple little read, kind of a companion piece to the Black Panther Party history. I really don't think that women get enough credit because it was the women of the Black Panther Party who did all of the heavy lifting. They ran the breakfast programs, they ran the medical clinics, they kept according to one of the article to one of the women here, she was their bookkeeper who kept the Panthers solvent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so that might be a good companion piece. All right, now, according to the Guardian newspaper, and these are old numbers, Joanne, 574 Black people have been killed so far by the police.
This year.
And those are the ones that we know about.
Right.
All right. Now, this to draw a parallel to the Black Panther Party, didn't they have a 10-point demand list that they wanted to
10-point platform? Yes.
They're a 10-point platform. I wonder if you can the author of the book can point that 10-point platform out, and if the murder of Chairman Fred Hampton of the Chicago Black Panther Party is in your book, it would be very interesting for people to read about what happened to Chairman Fred. Now, one more.
You sound
thing.
Very well informed about the Panthers.
I'm sorry?
You sound very well informed about the Panthers and their history.
Back in the day, and I have the peace sign now showing that you can't see. I was involved with a group, the Students for a Democratic Society.
Sure. Of course.
And we were allies of the Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it wasn't, as you pointed out, Joanne, it wasn't only a black Panther Party. There was a lot of quote white allies who were totally involved. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Just one more quick thing, and I'll get off the air. I saw this once on the corporate TV, and then it disappeared. Apparently, a special rapporteur from the United Nations studied the epidemic of violence against black people, murder, and the special rapporteur pointed out two things that really stuck out to me. He equates the lynching of black people in the early 20th century to the epidemic of violence against black people
today, and
he also said that part of the problem for this epidemic which I call ethnic cleansing and genocide, and those are my words. Part of the problem is that there's no consequence for law enforcement, and they know that going in.
Oh, no question. No question.
And in fact, law enforcement is rewarded for their behavior, right? Getting
promotions awards for killing unarmed people.
Right.
LJ,
right.
We're going to have to move on. Thank you so much.
Anyway, I will take my responses off the air. Time to move along. Joanne, God bless you for what you do. Keep on keeping on, girlfriend.
Same with you, my brother. You have a great day.
Bye, yeah, LJ. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And so he did talk about the 10-point plan, and I have to say that as I reviewed the 10-point plan of the Black Panther Party, it's the same list. Yeah. Today is the exact same list. If you're talking about what does equality look like, it's the exact same list.
Right, right. I mean, the 10-point platform and program was kind of the founding document of the party. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and some of the other early founders and leaders of the party came up with a list that they broke down into what we want, mm-hmm. what we want now, and right. what we believe. And those include freedom to determine the destiny of the Black community, full employment, a decent housing fit for shelter of human beings, education that reflects African American history. At the time it was written, the anti-Vietnam War movement was very strong, and they wanted all Black men to be exempt from military service. Mm-hmm. And in capital letters, in all bold letters, they want an end to police brutality and the murder of Black people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's part of the unfinished revolution, obviously.
Right.
Now it's become such a huge issue. I don't think it's ever gone away, ever, in the African American community. And I think when you talk to Panthers, when I've spoken to Panthers about the current, it seems like a string of murders, mm-hmm. of unarmed Black citizens.
Right.
It seems like a string to maybe mainstream society, but to them it's just a continuum. It's a continuation of what they've been fighting for. Even before the party was formed, and what they've been fighting after.
Ever since.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. You know, it's kind of ironic when you think about the platform piece about police brutality. What I've come to realize is that the Panther newspaper was the vehicle to share the information about what was happening in Black communities throughout the United States and quite frankly, the world. And so that was the vehicle to get information into the hands of the people, right?
Right.
Just like today, social media has become the new way that the public gets information directly.
Sure.
So it's not filtered. It's not coming through some corporate spin machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming directly from where the incident is taking place.
Right.
And so I think both of those give grassroots people a big advantage. When you can communicate directly to the public without the filters, what ends up happening is you have a much more aware and awake populace.
Exactly.
Right? Because now white middle class can't comfortably sit in their living rooms and say, we don't have a problem.
Exactly.
Right? Unless they're Donald Trump and they just don't want to see a problem.
Sure.
Right. And so I do think that had we had these tools, I mean, I normally ask, what would the Black Panther Party have been like if we had had internet and,
right.
you know, social media,
right.
right? It would have been a phenomenal, I mean, it already was phenomenal, but
right.
just think about how big it could have become.
Right. right.
Which was the fear, right?
Exactly.
Which was the fear.
Exactly. And I think the, to go back to your other question about, you know, something that I got out of this was, just the organizing savvy,
yes.
that they had,
right.
because at that time they had telephones,
right.
and they had knuckles,
right.
to knock
right.
on doors,
right.
like that's all they had,
and a mimeograph machine,
and a mimeograph machine.
Right, right, right.
That was yeah, you're right. They were constantly looking for ways to be able to print.
That's right.
Because they couldn't get a lot of mainstream businesses would not print what they wanted.
That's
what they wanted to print, and that's why they started their own entire printing facility for the newspaper,
right.
Which at its peak was, I believe, 250,000 copies a week.
That's right. Yeah,
going all throughout the country and the world.
In the world.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. I am speaking with Brian Shee. He is the co-author of The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. And so are you going to be, are you at another location in Portland? You were talking about going to Los Angeles later this week.
Right. I will be at Powell's Bookstore this evening at 7:30.
Oh, we should tell people that.
What a coincidence. What a coincidence that you brought that up.
Yes, yes, yes. Powell's
Okay, I'm out. I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Have a great day. Yes. Wonderful. 7:30 p.m. tonight at Powell's.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Excellent. Yep. I have a ballot measure form this evening, but I might be able to get there just in time to get you to sign my book.
I hope that'll be very cool. I hope to see you there.
I hope to be there as well. So Powell's is always a great place when authors come to town.
Beautiful bookstore.
Wonderful bookstore.
One of a kind.
Yeah, one of a kind, absolutely. One of the prides of Portland is Powell's Bookstore. So 7:30 p.m. this evening. This is Monday. I normally do Thursday morning, so I have to, in my brain,
recalibrate.
This is not Thursday. This is not Thursday. It's Monday.
Right.
We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Mike. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
I want to keep everything fair and balanced. You mentioned something about Donald Trump. What I want to say that Bill Clinton, when he was in the office, talk about the crime bill that they put out that resulted in all these black people getting thrown in American prisons. That was Bill Clinton. And Hillary probably was there somewhere, too. And also...
And your point?
Well, my point is that when you throw stuff out about Donald Trump, you're not talking about stuff that the Clintons did in terms of causing black people to be mass incarcerated from that crime bill. Also, all of these shootings that's going down right now are going down under a black administration, a black attorney general. So this is happening right now. On the watch of black people. So I just want you to, when you talk about that, why don't you bring that into the equation too? Thank you.
So, Mike, I'm not quite sure what point you're trying to make. Are you trying to make a point that black people are being killed while there's a black president in office? I would suggest that you probably do a little bit more reading about the history of America, because it doesn't matter who's in office. Black people have been killed. Black people have been sacrificed. Public policies have been passed to make sure that black people are not successful in the United States of America. So, you know, Trump is just a manifestation of everything else that's wrong with the United States of America. So I will leave that there. You want to join the conversation? The conversation that we're having is about the Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. Brian Shee will be at Powell's Bookstore this evening at 7:30. This is a wonderful, wonderful book, because most of the people you will read about are not people whose names you know. And I love that about this book.
That is... completely true. the approach that we took with the book is there's 45 portraits that I took, and the project actually started as a pure photography project.
Wow!
But in the process of taking these portraits, we had we rented studios, mm-hmm. we had catering and wine and music, and it was a celebration.
Oh.
Actually, and there were mini reunions that we had for the Panthers in the area.
Nice.
It was very nice, and I only had a few minutes with each subject, and so I just to relax them and, mm-hmm. and to not end up with passport photos.
Right, right. You did an incredible job. It's amazing to think that you only had a few minutes with most of them
for
take these pictures.
For most of them, only a few minutes, and. I did shoot on film, and it was pretty rare if I shot more than one roll of film on a person. Mm. And the way that happened is just through conversation, mm-hmm. partially. Mm-hmm. And of course, while we were talking, their stories come up.
Right, right.
And they were unfiltered and candid. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we just realized that this really wouldn't be complete without these stories. And I thought I was going to be getting away from journalism. But it really drew me back in just the best way, in the best way possible. And it mm-hmm. turned out to be one of my favorite aspects of doing the book was actually interviewing people with the same basic set of questions mm-hmm. and seeing where that would go for each different individual, because each story is quite different.
Right. I
noticed. And each person has their own opinion and they have their own viewpoint, and nobody sounds brainwashed.
Right.
Nobody sounds like they're trying to paint the Panthers with rose-colored mm-hmm. glasses. They look at the good, they look at the bad. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that I described it to one of the Panthers in the book was, I really wanted to engage in something that I called pointillist storytelling. Mm. So that when you talk to one or two people, you're going to get a certain image and certain angle. But if you talk to 45 people,
right,
who are not coordinating right. with each other,
right.
living in different parts of the country, haven't right. seen each other in years, if ever,
right.
Something very rich and something very vivid comes out when you look at these stories as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we really wanted to do, was, at least in the photographs, to really humanize people that we're not given that courtesy,
right?
Ever, and to really present them with the kind of dignity and strength mm-hmm. and pride, and even pain that they hold within themselves, and that they choose. That's the way that they choose to present themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that really hasn't been done. The Black Panthers, especially the rank and file members, were never really given a kind of extended vehicle mm-hmm. to describe their experiences for themselves.
Well, again, I think you have done such an incredible job, because I feel like what's interesting, and this is an art, because I don't think many journalists are able to do this, is to take a picture that feels like you have like looked into their soul, and then to tell a story that's short, that's concise, but very visual. So when you read it, it's as if you're there with them,
right.
walking through that experience.
Right.
I think that's a rare talent, and that's what this book did for me. I mean, these stories popped out, and I'm like, I know these people, right? These are my people. I know
right.
these people.
Right. It feels like a movie script when you read this.
It does. It really, and I kept thinking, well, gosh, this is like, and it reads so quickly. I mean, because you want to get to the next story, and you want to know what did this person do? Now, one of the things that I think is one of the biggest misunderstandings about the Black Panthers was that they were really just about armed revolution,
right.
as compared to educating the community so that the community would be at the lead in addressing the issues that were impacting their ability to thrive.
Exactly.
In their local community. And so whether it was the breakfast program, whether it was buying the ambulance so mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. People were able to get to the hospital. I was pretty appalled to find out, I think that was Winston-Salem.
It was Winston-Salem.
Winston-Salem, where if the ambulance driver didn't think you were sick enough, that they would charge you money in advance
exactly.
if you were Black
exactly.
To take you to seek treatment. And so people were dying because, A, they didn't have the money to pay in advance, and B, somebody was making an arbitrary decision, not based on health,
right.
but based on whether they thought you were sick enough.
Not, right? not a doctor, an ambulance driver.
Not a doctor, right. an ambulance driver, right.
right.
Talk a little bit about that experience, because so again, it was like
they saw a need in the community, and they decided, okay, well, if the powers that be aren't going to address this, this is a desperate need in the community, so we're going to buy an ambulance, and we're going to give people free rides to their healthcare place.
Exactly. And I think that the free ambulance program, that was unique to Winston-Salem, actually, exactly came out of their view for what was needed in the community. In that particular case, I believe the standard ambulance service basically closed. This is what it was. They closed down the local hospital, so people could no longer walk to that hospital or be driven to that hospital. And the ambulance service basically, for all intents and purposes, refused to pick up
black folks,
black people in their homes, no matter what kind of condition they were in. And so the Panthers in Winston-Salem got a $25,000 grant, I believe, from the Episcopalian Church, which I think that's a heavy-duty institution. And for them to go through the rigmarole of convincing them that they're not using this money to buy
arms,
or drugs or whatever it was, just shows the, I think, the integrity that most of the Panthers brought to the programs. And the programs, almost everybody mentions them in the interviews, because this was the day-to-day reality of the party.
Right.
The day-to-day reality of the party was not shootouts with the cops.
Right.
It was not internecine warfare. Those were definitely part and parcel of the party, and it's what the media focused on, because that's what sells.
That's right.
And that's where you have the image that is burned into people's memories, especially of that era, that the Black Panthers were men, black men armed with guns, out to kill Whitey. And I'm sitting here, your viewers, your listeners can't see me, but I'm not black. About the farthest from black you can get. I grew up in suburban California. And never once in the 5 years that I was working on this project did anyone ever say, who the hell are you to be telling our story, to be doing this project? And it was really a matter of our interests completely overlapped. They liked the pictures. They knew what I was trying to do. They knew that I was not doing a one-hit fly-by-night story about them. And so over time, this goes back to when I talked about building relationships and trust, that we ended up with something I think really special. And so far, the only thing negative that I've heard is just people upset about not being in the book. But I haven't heard from everybody. So, but I'm definitely open to those criticisms, just as they were freely criticizing themselves in the book, what we think, what they thought they did right, what they thought they did wrong. One of the interviews that came out was also actually out of Winston-Salem, was by a gentleman named Larry Little. And I think he gives a very forthright analysis of the strengths and weaknesses of the party, and especially the leadership of Huey Newton. Some people felt that the Stanley Nelson documentary really attacked Huey Newton. And what Larry expressed to me towards the end of our interview, he really opened up, and I felt like we were having a real moment. Like, you know, as an interview, you know something real is happening. And he had just said that when you talk to journalists, their experience talking to journalists is that you can have a one-hour amazing conversation. And you mention one negative thing. And that's all they'll write about. And he said that that's why so many Panthers refuse to talk to media, or they're super cautious about what they say. And that's why I feel our book did something special, because it kind of cracked open that shell, that defensiveness, to, in a way that I think can reach people that really might not otherwise be interested in the party, or or give credence to what they say.
Well, I certainly think that this book will go a long ways towards people understanding what's happening in the streets in America today, all across the country.
I'm sure there's parallels everything that they're talking about, I'm sure there's parallels. There's some analog, especially with Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
Or a million hoodies.
Right, right.
Any of the sort of modern social movements.
Standing up for racial showing up for racial justice. Is this pretty phenomenal group that started right after Trayvon Martin was killed, led by white people for white people to really have those deep conversations about racial justice and racial equality and what does that mean, and then actually organizing to be supporters of people of color-led movements. They've done some great work here in the Portland metro area and around the country, and they've grown leaps and bounds. And so there are places for people who really want to be engaged, because I do think one of the big parallels is we're kind of where we were, believe it or not, right after the Civil Rights Act was passed. We're kind of in this space and time where we've got a crazy person running for president that's racist, homophobic, sexist, just go down the list, at a time when Americans are fearful. They are fearful of everything.
That's not an accident.
It's not an accident. No. And he helps trump up that fear, right? So a fear-based election system where if you're paying attention, you don't really have confidence that we have a truly fair election system in the United States. So the potential of regular people voting in this election for a fearmonger who, in day one would be pushing the nuclear war button if he had an opportunity to. I think fear is what's driving this election cycle. And what we're not having is the rational conversation about who we are as a people and what we want to be as we move forward. And so what I hope is books like yours actually remind people that this isn't the first time we've been here. We've been here before, right? It might look a little different, but we've had this kind of fear mongering in our past. And we've survived it, but we survived it because we work together, we build coalitions, we just drew lines in the sand and said, this is not acceptable.
Right.
I love the fact that the Panthers were made up of 14, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. They weren't even 20 years old yet.
23-year-olds were senior citizens in the party.
Right. They were the old people, right? it's just fascinating to me because those young people took their own power, right? The adults didn't say, okay, go out and form your own little, street organization and go see what you can do, right? These young people were frustrated with the adults that were in their lives, the adults that were in leadership positions, and they decided that they could do better.
Right.
What a message for our young people.
Right. And they did it in a very systematic and thoughtful way.
Yes.
Which was the like I said before, the details of their organizing structure were fascinating to me. Billy X. Jennings, who actually opened the door for me to this very first project, he is based in Sacramento, and his organization, It's About Time, BPP.org, I believe, he runs probably the largest archive of Panther material, including the newspapers, posters, artwork, so many things from that era. His whole house is just filled to the brim with this. But he described to me in detail what they called the 10-10-10 program, which basically meant that Panthers in a certain area would be given a 10-block area to be responsible for. They were responsible for connecting with 10 people in that community. And those 10 people were each would be responsible for 10 people. And this was a kind of cellular structure to their telephone trees.
Right.
And so when something went down and they needed to rally people really quickly, this is how they did it. Now, Twitter, right, Facebook, email, right, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the analog version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it took shoe leather. It took talking to people on their porches,
yes,
and connecting with them where they were at that time.
Right.
And I think that's something that activists now. I'm very interested to talk to Melina Abdullah from Los Angeles, the Los Angeles chapter president of Black Lives Matter, to see how does that translate? How do you go from forwarding something or retweeting something that you agree with to actually taking action?
Right, to actually mobilizing people
exactly.
to do something. Absolutely true. If you want to join the conversation, we've just got about 10 minutes left. You can give us a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking to Brian Shee. He is the co-author of the Black Panthers Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution, and he will be at Powell's Books at 7:30 this evening, reading from his book, answering your questions, and selling a couple of them, I think, in the process. And so you might want to join them there. Again, the number is 503-231-8187. There's a lot to be proud of in this book. What would you say is one of the proudest accomplishments that you personally have made through this book?
The fact that I have this trust and the fact that I have these relationships and the fact that they still return my phone calls.
They still like you. Huh?
They still. So far, so good. There might be some people out there who are not happy for one reason or another. But I think the reason those relationships are intact, the reason that I still have this trust and that that I get a lot of hugs and thanks for this is I think not just me, but everybody involved in this project really approached it with a lot of integrity and transparency. And it wouldn't have happened without those things.
Well, you certainly wouldn't have got these heartfelt stories. The fact that people opened up and I think shared wounds and opportunities, missed opportunities. I mean, some of the stories are just, they just go right to the core of who we are as people, right? And so I really I've read a lot about the Black Panthers, and you're absolutely right. Most of what you read is truly about the leadership. But what I find fascinating is how even the part that the media highlighted about the Panthers with, you know, the black berets, the black leather jackets, the black rifles, this book actually talks about how that again came out of the community, right? Need to be protected from law enforcement,
right,
who were there really intimidating and pressuring community members.
Right, exactly.
So everything that they did, I believe, from their inception was really about, and how are we the people? We say we're here to help and we really want to help. And so how do we understand what the people need and then respond to that need.
Exactly. The party was never about one thing. It was never about guns. It was never about breakfast. It was about really planting the seeds for revolutionary change and revolution, which comes from revolutionary thought.
Right.
And that's why they studied the books of Frantz Fanon and Che Guevara and Mao. All of these thinkers, Marxist socialist thinkers, revolutionaries, and that's a lot of what they built their program on.
Right.
And the programs themselves were a manifestation of that,
right,
of self-reliance, of self-determination.
Right.
And I think a lot of people miss that because guns are sexy.
Right, right.
Fighting sells newspapers.
Right.
Like, why are the current election debates,
right,
some of the most watched in the world, because it's entertainment.
Oh, it's like watching a car accident. You just can't look away. You know you need to, right? But you can't look away. We got a couple of callers lined up. Hello, Bob. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi, John. It's the question that comes to me listening to this discussion is, if they were such good organizers, why aren't they here now? And the NAACP has survived, and including a lot of efforts by the FBI and others to subvert your organization.
Right.
But the Panthers didn't make it. Is it because they couldn't keep their leadership focused and in the country?
Well, thank you for the question. Would you like to tackle
sure.
that one?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. It's the, I think this goes back to a lot of different topics that we've been talking about. One was just the age. The Panthers were very young and full of bravado, and I think that might have actually hurt them in the long run because they did attract so much negative attention from the authorities. I think Cohen, you cannot talk about the Panthers without talking about the government repression that they did experience through COINTELPRO, which is very well documented. Actually, we include documents in our book that we thought were very telling about that. There was the split that happened, the historical split that was basically a division between Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, with Huey Newton wanting to emphasize the kind of program, the survival pending revolution programs, which is where things like the breakfast program or the bioremediation program or rent strikes and things like that came in, versus the armed revolution that Eldridge Cleaver was espousing. And that created, literally, it split the party in two. And I think, as one Panther, Madeline Rucker, said, they just weren't prepared for that, and they couldn't survive it. And I think no matter how well your day-to-day organization, how strong that is, there were just bigger forces that overwhelmed them.
Thank you. I think that was an excellent response. We got one more caller we're going to squeak in. Good morning, Ron. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, good morning, Joanne, and good morning to your author.
Good morning.
Brian Shee.
Good morning.
Ryan Shee. Thank you. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
I just wanted to compliment you on this book. This sounds like a great book. I'm going to try and get down and see you this evening.
Please, thank you.
And I agree that the Panthers did need a little bit of age wisdom there to keep them from going in the wrong direction. But unfortunately, they didn't have that. And it was the demise of their organization. But I appreciate this. I really do. And see you this evening.
Oh, that's all right. Wonderful. Thank you. What's your name?
Ron.
Ron. Great. I'll look for you there. Please introduce yourself.
I will. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate the call. And so I just want to say, Brian Shee, this has been a wonderfully delightful conversation. I could talk to you all day about this. I love the fact that history continues to repeat itself. And unless we listen to our elders, unless we understand how what's happening now was influenced by the Black Panther Party and what we can learn from their experience so that we don't repeat those same mistakes, I just think it's pretty phenomenal. And thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for having a vision to actually go and talk to these elders while they're here. So we get their stories from their mouth and not from someone interpreting what they were thinking.
Right, right. It's been all my pleasure, not only to work on this book, but also to speak with you here this morning.
Thank you very much. And this evening at 7:30 p.m. at Powell's Bookstore, Brian Shee will be there and will be answering your question and continuing this absolutely fascinating look back at 50 years of Black Panther. I think, as always, I want to make sure that young people understand that the only thing that's ever changed this country has been when young people have said enough. This isn't right, this isn't fair, and I'm going to fix this. And so let us continue that legacy of young people stepping into leadership and not waiting to be asked, just stepping in, because had the Panthers waited to be asked, they would not have gone down into the history books. And so I thank you very much. Hope you have a fabulous day. Enjoy beautiful Portland while you're here. You've been listening to Joanne Hardesty. It has been my pleasure to substitute today, but I will be back on Thursday, and I will be interviewing Norm Solomon, who is a long time author, publisher, and activist. And so we will be continuing this conversation about how we change our world then. It looks like I've maybe got one more minute left for About 30 seconds, he says. So, any last thoughts? Do you have a website by chance?
I do. It's just myname.com, Brian Shih, BryanShih.com.
Want to follow this photojournalist around? I think he's doing some great work. So
thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hope you have a great day. You've been listening to Joanne Hardesty, and I will see you next time. Hope you have a great Monday.
This is KBOO Portland. Good morning. It's 8:59. Coming up next, the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crybaby, produced and performed by Stageworks, Inc. Crybaby will take place at the Glickton Street Theater Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. Crybaby Live is a rockabilly musical homage to the John Waters cult classic film set in the 1950s in Baltimore. Again, that's Crybaby, the play, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, October 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library in Corvallis. The interactive and multimedia iBook is a collaboration between the Oboe Addy Legacy Project and the OSU Oregon Multicultural Archives to showcase the history and current community outreach of the Oboe Addy Legacy Project. Again, that's the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, February 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library, 3rd floor Willamette Room, 201 Southwest Waldo Place in Corvallis. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.